On this week's 51%, we chat with Kimberly Heckler about her book, A Woman of Firsts, Margaret Heckler, Political Trailblazer. A Massachusetts congresswoman in the 60s, 70s, and 80s, Margaret Heckler worked on bills like the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, Title IX, and the Equal Rights Amendment. In her new book, daughter-in-law Kimberly looks back on Margaret's legacy.
We are now at the 50th anniversary of that women's right to credit.
I'm Jesse King. It's all up next on 51%.
I was standing around like one of those girls I had seen in a movie. The whole world was a movie back then. I had my sunglasses on, I wanted to be seen without seeing Shiloh or Lita. I wasn't really in it, I didn't really get it.
You're listening to 51%, a WAMC production dedicated to women's issues and experiences. Thanks for joining us. I'm Jesse King. It's Women's History Month. All month long, we're working to bring you stories and interviews about women's history. And this year, we're also celebrating the 50th anniversary of a woman's right to credit. As crazy as it sounds, women weren't even allowed to open a credit card in their own name until the Equal Credit Opportunity Act was enacted toward the end of 1974, and it really got going in 1975. The lead sponsor of that bill in the House was Massachusetts Congresswoman Margaret Heckler. Heckler was a moderate Republican who served in Congress from 1967 to 1983. While she opposed abortion, she fought for women's rights on a number of other fronts. In addition to the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, Heckler worked on Title IX and the Equal Rights Amendment. And after her time in Congress, she went on to serve as Secretary of Health and Human Services and as Ambassador to Ireland during the Reagan administration. Heckler died in 2018 at age 87, but her daughter-in-law, Kimberly Heckler, remembers her as a woman of firsts. She's out with a new biography titled Just That, A Woman of Firsts, Margaret Heckler, Political Trailblazer. I recently sat down with Kimberly to chat about her mother-in-law's legacy, why she wanted to write the book, and what she was like.
She told so many stories to us when we would have Sunday night dinners, and I started putting my phone on the table and recording her. The stories were so many, and her roles were so many, that I just thought I was sitting with a historical figure, and I did not want to waste my time. I felt like anything else would be wasting an opportunity with this incredible woman that fought and was a trailblazer for women's rights.
Yeah, what was she like in person?
She was formal. She always came dressed for dinner, coming over to see the kids. There was always a scarf. She always had her lipstick on. Extremely feminine. And that part really, really impressed me. She also, anything that I wanted to do, she made the path open for me to do it. And even with this book, although I've always loved writing, this project really was brought on because of my absolute devotion to her and admiration to share her story.
Well, let's get into that story a bit. You know, tell me about Margaret's early life and how that sort of shaped who she became as a legislator.
Her parents came over back in 1910 from Limerick, County Limerick and County Leitrim. They came over through Ellis Island into New York, settled in Queens. Her father had always said, we don't want any children. We're just trying to make it in America, right? Her mother became an upstairs maid after many, many ads, no Irish need apply, right? So that was the scene. She gets pregnant with Margaret, and her father was in fact an alcoholic. And he had said, remember, we had said no children, so we're giving the child up. So she was fortunately taken in only 3 days before her birth to an old widow who took her in and raised her 18 years before she went off to college. And that ended up being a blessing for her through all Irish Catholic girls' schools. Margaret Heckler would be on scholarship, and it really would be the preparation ground for her walking later into the corridors of power.
Margaret Heckler would be elected to Massachusetts' 10th district in 1966. What pushed her into going into politics and wanting to serve in Congress?
So she did become a lawyer, and in fact, she applied to Harvard and got into Harvard, but they didn't want her because she was a woman. She was taking the place of a man. This was before Ruth Bader Ginsburg. Margaret Heckler graced the halls of Harvard Law. She would finish at Boston College Law School as the only woman in her class, and after that, she practiced law, became a part of the governor's council. This is before she ran for Congress. So what happened is, she got her feet wet in a smaller environment where only in Massachusetts, I believe, do they have this group of seven that sits around the governor to make sure that they're on the up and up, if you will. So Margaret was a counselor to the governor and had a district from Wellesley, Massachusetts, down south to Fall River, to the bottom of Massachusetts, if you will. And what was interesting is so many of the people that were serving with her, of course, they were all men. She was the only woman on the governor's council, and she saw a lot of people committing crimes on the governor's council. So she wanted to leave that position, and she decided to run for Congress because the same group of constituents, the same people in the same territories, would be a territory that she could run against, and they would have known and had previously received postcards from her after 3 years of being their governor's counselor. It led into her win against a much bigger opponent. It would be Joseph Martin, who had served in Congress for 42 years, Speaker of the House twice, a Republican institution. And she could have run as a Democrat or a Republican, but her husband said, run as a Republican because the Kennedys dominated the political landscape in the state of Massachusetts.
Yeah, what was it like for a woman to campaign back then? You know, was it all that much different from today, or are some of those barriers still there?
It was completely different. First of all, as she was out there were many people that came up to her and said, I would never vote for a woman, or you should be home with your children. But what she decided to do, which was very unique, she had an old crusty newspaper editor from the West Roxbury Times say to her, you need to look like a man. You need to enter a man's world to get into this because women were not running in political offices like this very often. So she said that it was like a costume. She wore a gray suit to blend into the Massachusetts sky so that people would listen to her policies and not focus on the fact that she was a woman. So she had to act like a man, and she was a lawyer, so she had the brain to go with it. And so when she won in 1966, coming in January of 1967, she would be the only newly elected woman to Congress, if you can imagine it. 70 men and Margaret Heckler.
Looking at her policies, you know, what were some of the biggest issues that she wanted to work on? You know, your book touches on obviously her work with the ERA, the Equal Credit Opportunity Act, Title IX. Did she go in thinking, you know, I want to work on women's rights?
Well, it got switched on her. She first wanted to be on the Judiciary Committee. She was, in fact, a lawyer, and so she felt like this was a committee that she should be able to be on, but she was discriminated against joining. The man that was the chairman said, you know, we won't have a woman on the Judiciary Committee. So she chose to be on Veterans Affairs. Her father had served in the Navy, and believe it or not, even though she was estranged from her father, she decided to join Veterans Affairs. The Vietnam War was going on. It had been going on for 10 years when she entered Congress. So by being on Veterans Affairs, again, the only woman on a male bastion committee, she really had a say in what was going on with the veteran because she was responsible for the vets once they came back. But she also flew to Vietnam the first year as a congresswoman to say, I need to see what's going on over there. I don't want this war to continue. And she actually asked Lyndon B. Johnson, the president, when he met with the new freshman congressman and Margaret, if any of you have any questions for me, her hand was the first one up. And he said, well, little lady, what do you have for me? And she said, "Mr. President, what is going on? Why can't we end this war in Vietnam?" And he yelled and he screamed obscenities at her. It was definitely a hot topic for him and a very emotional one. And after he was done and calmed down, she looked at him and said, "Mr. President, you still haven't answered my question." So she went straight for Veterans Affairs, but she also, her very big push was more of a, not just for women in her district, but for women nationally. She was discriminated against. And although she felt that with men, she said, we don't want to be the same as men, merely equal as human beings. And she went about to make that happen. Hers was a fight for the right for credit, the right for the Equal Rights Amendment, and the right for Title IX. This all occurred during her 16 years in Congress. And during that second wave of feminism, these three laws happened. Now, the Equal Rights Amendment never actually passed, but it certainly, she put a lot of work behind the passing of the Equal Rights Amendment, but they were short three states. She did get it through with the help of Martha Griffiths, a Democrat on the left, one of her dear friends. They got it passed through the House and the Senate, only to not be passed through the states. So that was one of her greatest disappointments. But the Equal Credit Opportunity Act was her greatest legislative act. And that was the law that gave women, for the first time in American history, the right to credit in their own name. No woman could go into a JCPenney's, buy a car, do a mortgage on a house, until on the banking committee, she was serving with 37 men and one woman, a widow. She had to talk the 37 men into the idea of allowing and having the banks be open to women coming in and getting a credit card. The men came on board, but the widow, of all people, was her biggest struggle. The widow said, women don't pay their bills, and I am not for the passage of this bill. So not only did she have to convince the men, but she would have to convince the only woman besides herself on the Banking and Currency Committee. Can you imagine?
You know, I've been doing this show long enough, or sitting in this interview chair long enough, that I can imagine it a little bit. But, you know, it's definitely frustrating to know that you have to convince everyone in the room to get on board with women's rights. Especially in that case, you think that as a widow, that lawmaker would understand the importance of being able to control your own finances.
With that woman, she really was pulling the ladder up after herself. And when Margaret asked her in front of the entire committee, how could you, a widow, have this perspective? And she said, well, I've kept my deceased husband's roles alive. In other words, all of the credit, she could walk anywhere in and use his credit cards, which was very disappointing for Margaret. That was her biggest battle. Her biggest battle for women, even after the law was signed in 1974 for women to get credit in their own name, women still had a problem with economic equality. And that's why she fought for the Equal Rights Amendment, because she knew that in any committee that she would join, trying to fight for women, if when she was a lawyer and was sitting at this desk and the man in the next office was sitting at that desk, she could count on the fact that she would be getting paid less than him. And in most positions today, that is still the case. But she certainly pushed that goal forward of getting more women into positions of power and closing the gap of economic inequality. You know, I just finished with the Equal Credit Opportunity Act by saying that we are now at the 50th anniversary of that women's right to credit. This year for us, 2025, marks, it's been 50 years since that law was signed and now implemented. But before she went on to become the Secretary of Health and Human Services, there was one other significant thing that stands out in my mind. Of course, she did so many things because she served on the Joint Economic, the Banking and Currency, Veterans Affairs, and the Agricultural Committee. So, but in speaking specifically In 1980, Ronald Reagan was a nominee for president. And at the Republican National Convention, Margaret was still trying to convince this nominee to support the Equal Rights Amendment. And he said, I will not if I become president. I am not for it as an amendment. I will support fair labor laws, but I will not support it as an amendment to the Constitution. And so behind closed doors in a private meeting, he said to her, now that's going to hurt me, isn't it, for the woman's vote, right? Because he was running for president in just a few months after this Republican National Convention. And she said, well, women will have a hard time taking you seriously, that you're not advocating for them. And he said, well, now what do you suppose I do? And she said, now you appoint a woman to the Supreme Court. So by the end of that meeting, he said, that's a very good idea. By the end of the 45-minute meeting, she said, Mr. Reagan, will you do it? Will you appoint a woman to the Supreme Court if you become president of the United States? And he said, I will.
Wow. Well, Margaret Heckler lost re-election in 1982, but then she was appointed Secretary of Health and Human Services in the Reagan administration. It was, you know, kind of a short stint compared to her time as a congresswoman. She was only in the job for about like 2.5 years. But what was her focus as Secretary of Health and Human Services?
So again, she came in as one of the only women, but in this job, it was known as the hardest job in Washington. The Health and Human Services Department was the largest government department. Most people thought it was defense, but in fact, in 1983, when Margaret was quoted as being one of the most powerful women in Washington, and in fact, one of the most powerful women in America, she had under HHS 350 departments, 145,000 employees, and the third largest budget in the world. The first being the entire federal budget, the second being the entire budget of the Soviet Union, and the third being her budget, HHS. So no sooner had she gotten sworn in than AIDS was striking America. And she had no idea that this was going to happen on her watch. And the Reagan administration was quite quiet on it, because they were a more conservative administration. And this definitely was an issue that was hitting the homosexual community. And Margaret took it and ran with it and made it the number one priority in America, asking for federal funds, going to the Office of Management and Budget, and requesting that more money gets poured into a solution, a cure, a vaccine, and a blood test. So she spent a lot of her time there at the beginning just visiting AIDS patients and trying to calm the quell and the hysteria that was happening, not so differently, but than what we just experienced with COVID, not wanting to drink from water fountains, you know, not wanting to send kids to school, no swimming pools, that type of thing. So it was a serious health issue with America. And then simultaneously at that time, the Reagan administration was trying to cut Medicare, whereby people were, if they were terminally ill in the hospitals, it was determined that they go home to die. Mm-hmm. And so that was not going to happen on her watch. The compassion for the people and death with dignity was her stance. Hospice was a service that was occurring in 12 or 14 small locations around the country where you could take your loved one if they needed to have any type of drugs or medication. But it was not a federal program until Margaret Heckler became Secretary of Health and Human Services. And so with the support of Congress, she was able to, from scratch, with her staff at HHS, build the first federalized hospice program in America.
Wow. Well, looking at her legacy and sort of where we are today, you know, what do you think she would make of today's political landscape, especially when it comes to women? Because, I mean, you know, we have a lot more women in office, but we're also seeing pushback against things like DEI programs. Obviously, you know, there's the fall of Roe v. Wade, but the ERA that she worked on and that she supported is still in limbo.
I think that she would be proud of the fact that women are going to college more. There are more women than men going to law school. She would love that because she was only 1% of women attending law school when she came. She would love the fact that more women are in high-level positions, that in Congress, when she started the first women's club, and there were only 11 women in Congress, now there's well over 150 women that grace the halls of Congress. So across the board, I would say that she would be very, very pleased, and she would give the advice that for anything that a woman would want to do, one of her famous quotes is, "I'm not waiting," and she wouldn't want women to wait. She would want them to go for any position as long as they were qualified and have a productive and joyful life.
Well, thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me. Is there anything that we haven't touched on yet about Margaret that you want to make sure people know or about the book?
You know, I think at the end of it, I would just say that most of her work and her desire to help people came from a disposition of the heart. She recognized the inherent dignity and the moral equality of all Americans, and that was her passion. She had a passion for equality based on people's qualifications, of course, but hers was a passion that every American could reach and have, as she did, the American dream.
Kimberly Heckler is the daughter-in-law of the late politician Margaret Heckler, who fought for bills like Title IX, the Equal Rights Amendment, and the Equal Credit Opportunity Act. Kimberly's biography on Margaret is called A Woman of First, Margaret Heckler, Political Trailblazer. It's out now from Lions Press. Authorities in New York State are working to increase public safety on college campuses, specifically by combating domestic and gender-based violence, as well as sexual assault. WAMC's Alexander Babby reports, but just a heads up to our listeners, this segment, which lasts about 4 minutes, discusses sexual assault and domestic violence. If you or someone you love has been impacted, the National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE.
State officials say the vast majority of sexual and gender-based violence goes unreported at New York's higher education institutions. A discussion at State Police Headquarters in Albany focused on the role of campus safety organizations in preventing rapes, assaults, stalking, and other crime, and supporting victims. Kelly Nicholas Owens is Executive Director of the New York State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence.
All of the systems that interact with a survivor or victim of domestic violence have three pillars in what and how they approach it. That it's survivor-centered, meaning the survivor's in the driver's seat on how we respond. That it's trauma-informed, and that it's culturally responsive. And that we can't just take that one incident because there's historical trauma.
In addition to being the only state with a cabinet-level position for domestic violence prevention, New York also recognizes April as Sexual Assault Prevention Month. State Police Superintendent James Bruin says sexual violence is a serious challenge facing colleges and universities across the state. He says most cases are not reported to police.
I took the liberty to review some statistics which indicate 1 in 5 women and 1 in 16 men were sexually assaulted while going to college. It's estimated that 80% of sexual assaults on college campuses go unreported.
Megan Malone is a gender violence prevention specialist with the State Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence. She says language is key and says many survivors don't feel that they're victims. She says responders need to be able to understand the victim's perspective.
On the other side of that is abusive partner individual. There may be victims that are kind of off put by hearing the words abuser, perpetrator, possibly their ex-partners, current partners. Being called those things can be scary, off-putting. So just listening to how they are referring to that person.
Former NFL and Syracuse University quarterback Don McPherson is working with the state on a project called Aspire New York. McPherson wants to change how sexual assault and violence is talked about on campus. While a vast majority of gender-based violence is perpetrated by men, McPherson says heaping blame with labels like toxic masculinity does nothing to help.
It is the silence of men that has allowed that term to characterize a generation of boys who've only heard their identity discussed in terms of being toxic. And I always remind people, before we use toxic to talk about masculinity or relationships, we most often use toxic to talk about waste.
Instead, McPherson teaches what he calls aspirational masculinity.
We need to reach them with a message that talks about not just prevention of violent crime or sexual crimes, but the promotion of what it means to be a healthy and whole person in a civil and just and peaceful society.
Campus police officers agree. Caitlin Clark is an investigator with the State University of New York at Mooresville in central Madison County.
You'd be shocked as how we actually do have a lot of similar incidents compared to larger campuses. It's just, I think we have to be more creative being a smaller college with our resources and getting our students what they may need.
Clark says her department needs more of three things: state support, officers, and training.
I want to train more than just the bare minimum. We train to minimums, like our standards are minimum standards, and I would love to see the support to get us more training and continuous training.
The Office for the Prevention of Domestic Violence recommends anyone experiencing sexual or gender-based violence to seek medical attention, even if they feel they're not injured. The state's domestic and sexual violence hotline is 1-800-942-6906. For WAMC News in Albany, I'm Alexander Babby.
Thank you, Alex. Again, if you or someone you love has been impacted by these issues, help is available. In addition to the resources that Alexander mentioned, the National Domestic Violence Hotline is available 24/7 at 1-800-799-SAFE or by texting START to 88788. And RAIN's National Sexual Assault Hotline is available at 1-800-656-4673. You've been listening to 51%. 51% is a national production of WAMC Northeast Public Radio based in Albany, New York. It's produced and hosted by me, Jesse King. Our associate producer is Madeline Reynolds, and our theme is Lolita by the Albany-based artist Girl Blue. Just a reminder that you can listen to 51% anytime at our website, wamcpodcast.org, or wherever you get your podcasts. And you can stay in the loop on all of WAMC's shows by signing up for our weekly newsletter, Airwaves, at wamc.org. We hope you'll join us next week. Until then, I'm Jesse King, 51%.
I was every single girl, I was nobody else, I was so sure of myself. I was 15 and a half. He was a hollow laugh. And I lost my cool somewhere along the way. A nightmare down the hallway. I had to learn how to look away. I lost my cool.